right. It's hard to stop that song. Really hard to stop that song.
Can you understand the words?
You know, that was never the point, though.
It was the implication that it meant something beyond all nastiness. Huh?
It's...
So it's a magic song.
Yeah, there you go. And welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today's show, that was Joan Jett and the Blackhearts from I Love Rock and Roll and Louie Louie. And I'm going to have... Better watch it, Ricky, because I may have you sing that song. Back into the show, we're going to be talking with Charles Bowden. He's the author of Murder City. It's a book about Juarez, and it's a very heavy book, and I'm really looking forward to talking to him about that, about the situation in not just Mexico, but in Juarez and the implications of that and where it comes from. Like I said, it's a very beautiful and very heavy book. And opening up the show, I'm very pleased to welcome back one of my best friends in the world, Ricky Lee Jones. Ricky, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure.
It's funny you say that because when you were at my daughter's birthday party last week and discussing how much you didn't like the Hurt Locker, you were standing there with the shadow behind you. You were so iconic. It was really, I went, wow, you felt like all the places we've ever been. You felt like that commune in 1969, and you had some fatherness about you, which is to say, it felt like you cared. And I just looked at you. I just was in love with you.
Okay. I had a very good time myself.
You.
No. I really appreciate that, I think. And it's rare that we actually are able to make connections in the world in that kind of way. And I think it's really good. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to just in general have you in. But I also, we have not had the opportunity to talk about your new album, Balm in Gilead. And having listened to that from the early, early stages of that, sitting in that tiny little car, and if people know how big I am, it's like that was a little bit of car for a lot of person, okay? And
had to have the windows up so we could hear it.
That's right. And loud. And it was great. It was a really great experience. The album, Balm in Gilead, let's talk about that a little bit.
It's okay.
It's a very different album for you in a certain sense. It's different from the last one. It's also different from the Evening of My Best Day.
Yeah.
But it's actually, in some ways it's got its roots, I think, not just because some of the songs come from many years ago, but also in terms of finishing them and rewriting them and recasting them. But it's got its roots, and it becomes a very personal story that in a lot of ways concentrates so much that's universal for humanity. So what were you thinking about with Balm in Gilead?
I think it, in spite of me planning and setting out to make a record, it seems to feel accidental because there's always circumstance that impedes your plan. So that's what makes it a living and personal thing. I set out to make a more acoustic and invite a kind of country feeling, which I've never explored country. So I went, I'm going to go down a bluegrass door into blues and country. But my circumstances, my life, kept interfering. So I started out making the old song, redoing the old songs, with the purpose of being able to control some of the money. If I either do it like it was or do it totally different, but then I can license my songs and make more money. But a few weeks into it, I was already writing. And so then it was again half this, half that. So the other half took over. So when you ask me about personal, I think the personal part of my life is, as you just said, is the only thing that's universal. That's what speaks to us all, our broken hearts, our dying parents, our wayward children. And the music is the magical language that, that helps us all talk about it. Yeah?
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a listen to the first track on this, which I just love.
Yeah,
Wild Girl. It's like and we'll talk about it as soon as we hear it. But let's take a listen to the first track on this, Wild Girl.
Thank you. sugar and spice, what they want a girl to be.
Welcome back. That was Wild Girl by Ricky Lee Jones from her album Balm and Gilead. And you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today I'm talking with Ricky Lee Jones live in studio, sitting across from me with a big smile on her face. Ricky, let's talk about that song.
Okay.
It's a beautiful, beautiful song, and it's one that you had begun a long time ago and finished for this album.
Yeah.
And went through a lot of, I imagine, a lot of your life came into that song. Can you talk about that a little?
I think I started it after the magazine, and it was maybe one of the first trickling songs for what would eventually be Flying Cowboys, but never made it on. It was written about the same time as Atlas's Marker, Wild Girl, and some other tune. And initially I was thinking of a girl that everybody, you know, the loose girl in high school out behind the bleachers. I was thinking of her and wanted to pull her back. So that's all. That was the image. And then I wrote the first verse, Wild Girl, You Must Have Been a Terror. Wild Girl in the Red Dress, Come On, Say Yes. Walk right in the real world and know it. You bring things back into the real world. Say, take me back. I just want to make my dreams. I came here to love somebody, too. I still want to make my dreams come true. And that's what I had. But and actually, the first one had a Cinderella man in it, For Your Cinderella Man. And, that's a big phrase, and I got stuck with it. And I think it might have been one of the reasons I could not finish the song. So years went by. I would sing it. It's very emotional, but I don't know why, and it would not die, So about the last 4 or 5 years, I began to think of my daughter when I sang it and thought, is something about the sorrow? Or so when I first wrote it, I wasn't a mother. I was a songwriter talking, but now I was a mother talking to the daughter. And as when I got rid of Cinderella Man and left the boys out of it, I was able to finish the song. And that happened, you don't know how many times I tried to write this song. But once I thought, I'm going to talk to Charlotte, I finished it in a few days.
Now, one of the lines in there that just really grabs me, the whole thing, everything that you're talking about was, really grabs at your heart. But there's one in there that I thought, in particular, after you came back from your tour and we were having lunch last week, and you were on fire in a certain sense, in a way that I thought was really good. And there's a line in here that I thought, again, this is the personal becoming universal, that this point about the thing that makes you beautiful doesn't come out of a jar.
Yeah.
And as I heard that song, as I heard that line in the last week, I kept thinking about all the things that have been going on in your head around the treatment and objectification of women and how important a song is, even in speaking to them.
Yeah. When I used to drive Charlotte to school when she was in the second and third grade, we would drive through the parade of, pornography that's pretending to sell a product. There was one in particular on, and they're selling shoes, but all you see is her boobs and her mouth open and the same thing, same makeup. And I thought, I don't want my daughter to see this because there aren't any men. We don't have little testicle bras where their balls are sticking out. And oh, sorry. there's nothing to make it equal where on the other side, men get the message that they're also subjected to. Anyway, so, which is, I wouldn't want that. But so I moved from L.A., and tried to raise her in an environment where there weren't ads everywhere. So we, in spite of that, of course, she's a free-thinking girl, and she was always a girly girl. She was always in the hippie school. She was always the one who wore little gold shoes and dresses. So she, so all the girls have pressure to be a sexual object for somebody. And may I name the name of the store we were talking about?
Sure.
Okay. So the one that's been bothering me especially is American Apparel. Because of who it appeals to, because of how it disguises itself or has pretended to disguise itself as a kind of hip store. But these ads for the store, every one of them, they look like pornography to me, And we can have a discussion about why that's so objectionable to me. Or the ads, anyway, pretending to sell clothes. And so I was thinking of making my own personal protest and inviting others. And so I guess it has always mattered. I don't think I'm a homely woman. I think I'm a good-looking woman. But I have never felt like I had to put on makeup in order to go out into the world, ever. I didn't shave my legs. And I see a generation of women who have no sense, many of them who have no sense of self in their own bodies, in their own eyes. And then, my hairy legs are very sexy,
Well, this is the point. Even with the point about pornography and all these ads and everything else, it's like the complete objectification and degradation of women.
Absolutely.
And the idea that even the idea that a woman is a detached body, detached from any person, any personality, any being, it's just a picture, and it's sort of, and it's what's it meant to elicit, to me, I think you're right on the money with it. So it's sort of,
you've hit me to how much capitalism, you know, insipidly predisposes us to not paying attention to these things, to accepting them as normal. If you talk to a lot of people about it, you know, their sexism is so so much a part of them that they don't even know what they're saying, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the girls too, not just the boys, girls as well.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners that this is The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today to Ricky Lee Jones. We're talking about her album, Balm and Gilead, and all things of great importance in the world. There you go, Ricky. You know, I'm going to switch things up a little bit because I don't want to run out of time and not get to play this song. So I want to play the whole song, which is a song that I know you put a lot of heart into writing and singing.
Yeah.
And it's also a song that's been probably very controversial in a certain sense because, I read things that, just these stupid little sniping things. And I was talking to a friend on the way in this morning and we were listening to the song. And we were just like both so moved by the beauty of it. So, Melissa, we're going to listen to The Gospel of Carlos Norman and Smith, which is track 4. Okay, so let's go to track 4.
A criminal, what is the crime? Poison is the pin, writing down is a children's nursery rhyme. Didn't you see him standing next to me? But the seeds of change have grown, we don't have to hide anymore. Trouble on the other side. Lo, but baby, it's a troubleful heart. It's a troubleful heart. It doesn't take much to see if you're looking for an enemy. Greed and apathy spell the letters of our name. Yes, sit and laugh at other people falling, making money off their shame and sorrow, or waiting for tomorrow to fix itself.
Love, 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 baby.
Welcome back. That's the Gospel of Carlos Norman and Smith from Balm and Gilead, Ricky Lee Jones' latest album. And Ricky's sitting with me live in studio, and it's singing along with the song.
I'm excited to talk about this song.
Well, let's jump into it. Let's talk about it.
So when I did The Evening of My Best Day, which I think is about 8 years ago, I wrote a song called Ugly Man. When I wrote Ugly Man, I was thinking so much about the Black Panthers, this moment in history in the late 60s when, I don't know why, but for some reason for me, it began to symbolize something intensely personal. Maybe from out of the ruins in the Black community because of Malcolm X or for whatever reason, but now they are protecting themselves. They have power. They have family. That's how it looks to me. So I hold this because my family was so, broken. I hold this like a little pearl. And that pearl began to speak to me in about 2001. So I wrote Ugly Man about George Bush, more or less. But the horns were the Black Panthers. And I always envisioned a big choir of Panthers standing in back of me as I sang that song, playing the horns. So then when I wrote and remembering and always thinking of, in case everybody doesn't know who the three are, remembering that moment in the Olympics when the two athletes held their fists in a salute of power and self-respect.
Olympics, yeah.
So the three names, the one that's not usually included is Normand. And forgive me, I don't remember his first name, but he was an Australian athlete who stood with them on the podium. And when you first look at it, you go, oh, he's got his head down and he's not looking with him. But subsequently I read he wore a pin of unity, racial unity. He didn't stand with his fist up, but he did stand with them, and he's often left out of the story in America. So anyway, it's an important moment in my life, and I think a pivotal moment in American history. And I was thinking of, and it wasn't about Obama, and it wasn't even inspired by. I was just thinking how their lives were so broken afterwards by the event. And yet now some kind of redemption comes to them. It can't just be, a black light poster. It means something to us.
Well, you actually, one of the lines that's in the song, you call up this question of, look, what does it mean to not stand up and say something when times demand it, basically? That's not the words, but I got the feeling that that's the sense of what you call for. And like, when it's not popular to speak out is exactly the time to speak out. And even when, in the worst conditions, you have to actually stand up and say something.
That's when it matters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I felt that so much during the first two or three years of Bush that we were in grave danger, and we were in grave danger, but we were in danger of really losing our right to speak out. And it took almost an entire term before people began to speak out against Bush. And I was just, my head was spinning. I went, how could we lose it so quickly? People are afraid of losing their jobs, getting kicked out of school for saying they don't like the president, getting kicked out of school, So, yes, that's been my banner for since Bush placed himself in office.
Mm-hmm. All right, I hate to say this, but we're running out of time.
We'll come back and do a marathon, Ricky Michael.
There you go. We'll seize the studio and we'll just take over. We'll do it from master control. Okay.
One thing that I wanted to tell you is that song also was an evolution. It started out a big gospel tune, and then finally I broke it down and put John Bryan on it and made it very quiet. But maybe one day we'll hear the big, big, louder, faster version.
That'd be great. And the album is Balm and Gilead. It has a lot of really interesting people that drop by to help you out. Ben Harper, Alison Krauss,
Victoria Williams,
Bill Frisell. Vic Chestnut. Yeah, in fact, right before he died, actually, which is, it's an amazing album, Balm and Gilead. And Ricky Lee Jones, always a pleasure.
So wonderful. Thanks for finally getting me out here.
Well, I'm going to rope you and keep you up in here, and we'll get you here more often.
Yes, sir.
Just to come in. We will do something. Now, you have a show coming up, too? Is that?
Oh, I'm going back on tour in a month. Okay. And I think we're going to play the pier in August.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Very cool.
I'm probably get some horns and do my big Black Panther thing at last.
That'll be great. That'll be tremendous. I really look forward to that. Ricky, yeah. Great having you on the
Thank
show.
You, sir.
Okay. Talk to you again
See
soon.
See you in a minute.
Okay. I'm Michael Slate, and you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we've been talking with Ricky Lee Jones, artist and truly wonderful person. And we've been talking about her album, Balm and Gilead, and all things important in the world. And we're going to take a short break and be right back with Charles Bowden. Welcome back. That is Los Tigres del Norte, and the song is Las Mujeres de Juarez. It's from their album Pacto Sangre. Pacto de Sangre. It's an amazing album, amazing song, and joining us to talk about Juarez is Charles Bowden. Talk about his book, Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's from Nation Books. Charles Bowden is a prolific author, and he's written quite a bit on exactly this question. A lot of the inhuman and in just the terrible things that are going on against humanity in Mexico and especially around Juarez. And this book is, I have to tell you, just to begin this, I read this book over the last couple of weeks and I was stunned. And Charles, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, one of the things I'll say straight off is you have such a tremendous writing style in terms of the you don't approach this. You're a journalist, but you write in a very poetic manner. And the power of that really got to me was that it has the effect of drawing you into exactly what you've been living through in terms of the horror that you've been in the midst of and trying to make sense of. You know, you could feel the weight on that bears down on you, but also bears down on the people in Mexico and in Juarez in particular. You know, and as I was reading it, the Mexican government came out with a report about more than 22,000 people have been killed in the last 3 years during their so-called war on drugs. And you make the point in your book that 28% of the people killed are in Juarez, and that in many ways, Juarez is not just the front line of a war, so-called war, but the concentration of a larger war. Can you give people a sense of what it's like to be human and living in Juarez today?
Yes. You're never going to be safe. There will be no one out at night. You will live in a city where 25% of the houses have been abandoned. You will live in a city with 4 police forces, which are all dangerous and threatening. You'll be occupied by 11,000 federal police and army, who are all dangerous. You'll live in a city where 100,000 jobs have disappeared in the last year or so, where 40% of the businesses have closed. And you'll live in a city with a murder rate of about 200 per 100,000. For example, in Los Angeles, it's about 10 per 100,000. In New York, it's about 6 per 100,000. And you'll have one other thing that'll make your life a little different. You will know that if you are murdered, no one will ever be arrested or convicted, because you will know in 2009, when over 2,700 people were murdered, there were only 30 arrests for homicides, and most of those were just showboat things that led to nothing.
Boy. Go ahead.
Good enough thumbnail for you?
Yeah. I think that gives people a sense of what we're talking about here. Now, one of the things is, why did Juarez become such a concentration of all this?
An accident both of geography and of policy. Juarez is across from El Paso, and it's always been a key crossing point. During the Mexican Revolution, was a major crossing point for guns going south to the revolutionaries, for example. So it's fated by geography to be a crossroad, just like Chicago. The other factors are the North American Free Trade Agreement of 1994 sent hundreds of factories, foreign factories, into wars, principally American, recruited a population of poor people from all over Mexico to work in these factories, and created a huge sprawling city of slave wages. These factories have a turnover of 100 to 200% a year because nobody can live on the wages. Then the other factor is the United States, quote, war on drugs. You take a major crossroad, you enhance a product with enormous profit, meaning illicit drugs, and they're going to flow through Juarez, because Juarez and El Paso connect with the major transportation arteries of the United States. So it's an inescapable circumstance. And finally, you get the recent president, Felipe Calderón of Mexico, deciding to show he's the man by turning the army loose on the Mexican drug industry. And Juarez, for all the reasons I've just stated, becomes the absolute laboratory of slaughter. We now have 5,000 dead in a little less than 3 years in the city, and no one will ever know the exact tally of the dead. People disappear all the time. They're not counted. Most people get kidnapped all the time. Most of them don't come back. They're not counted. We keep finding secret cemeteries, what they call death houses. In the spring of 2008, they took 46 people out of two death houses, corpses. They're never counted. So we're seeing something without precedent. This city is now the most violent in the world, and there's no way to predict it ending. There's 500 to 900 street gangs there. They're all feral. We've raised two generations, at least, of feral kids in the street because their parents work for peanuts in these factories. 50% of the adolescents in Juarez neither are in school, nor do they have jobs. It's like a perpetual motion machine, given the conditions.
Mm. You know, one of the things that, probably the only thing that many people know about Juarez, and even there, not enough people know this, but the subject of the Los Tigres song, you know, is the glaring mass murder of, rape and mass murder of hundreds of young women from the maquiladoras. Is there a relationship between that mass murder of women and the murders that you're talking about?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because frankly, that issue is something treasured so that American academics, in their gutless way, never have to look at Juarez. Look at over a 13 or 15-year period, there were 400 murdered women in Juarez. The rate of murder in Juarez of females is the same as in Mexico, about 10%. Of that 400, two-thirds were instantly solved because they were killed by lovers and husbands who sat there drunkenly over the corpse. At the same time, 90 to 95% of the murders are males. Now, one of the characteristics of these murders, often touted by American academics, is that the murders of the women aren't solved. Murders in Mexico are never solved. They don't have a justice system that solves things. 93% of the people convicted in Mexican courts never see a judge and never see an arrest warrant. 93% of the people convicted in Mexican courts are convicted without physical evidence. What's going on in Juarez is a U.S., in good part, a U.S.-financed city with 400 factories that produces violence against everyone. We're killing babies over there now with machine guns, you know. But if you look, if you take a little strand and focus on it, you can ignore the real hell that's been created. A city of huge poverty, no future, no law enforcement, mass violence, and increasingly a city of despair. 30 to 60,000 people from Juarez, estimates vary, mainly affluent, have fled the city and moved to El Paso, bought houses, and sit there with their money. The middle class is basically being destroyed in Juarez and in much of Mexico. And what it's come down to, the other thing in this fabled drug war, It's most of the people getting killed in Juarez and throughout Mexico, most of the 23,000 officially counted, are just poor people. They're not capos. They're not big guys. This is a slaughter, kind of almost social cleansing, going on throughout the country under the mask of somehow fighting a war against drugs.
Well, let's dig into this a little bit more, because I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, there's different explanations, and, you know, they come from everybody, the different explanations of this mass murder that's going on, you know, that from the, you know, and you've begun to speak to some of this, the idea that it's cartels fighting against each other, or it's a real war on drugs, and the government is just simply fighting against the cartels. And you argue forcefully against each one of these. And I'd like to, you know, have you speak to why they aren't what's going on, and where's the truth? And then as part of that, the role of the army and the police and the role of the government, because I think you do
sure.
brilliant exposure around that.
Oh, sure. The cartels are, quote, the cartels, these drug organizations, are always fighting each other. You know, they have shifting alliances. The bloodiest year in the history of Juarez up to that year was 2007, where they killed 307 people. The next year it went to 1,600, then 2,700, and this year is going to be a world beater. You can't explain this for two reasons as cartel violence. One, the cartels never achieve this level of violence. That's the first reason. The second reason is people in the cartels aren't dying. Now, the other premise is that the Mexican government is fighting these drug organizations heroically, incidentally doing it with $500 million a year of U.S. money. Now, since the war started, we have about 23,000 people executed in what the Mexican government says is a drug war. There have been 100 soldiers killed. I mean, this is preposterous. You seriously think that these drug organizations, with their fine weaponry and everything, are being slaughtered to the tune of 23,000 and only 100 soldiers die? They're not attacking them at all. I'll give your listeners another statistic. The Mexican government announced officially they had arrested 53,000 people connected with drug organizations. Only less than 2% of those came from the major cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, run by a man named Chapo Guzman. This is all a fiction. What the army's doing is going into areas and killing anybody they want. They're kidnapping people, they're torturing people, they're raping people, and they're certainly robbing people. They have been unleashed on the Mexican people. What has happened as a consequence of that, and there's 250,000 people in the Mexican army, I should interject here that in a six-year period, 150,000 of them deserted, primarily, according to U.S. intelligence, to join the drug business where you can kill and get better pay. But what they're doing is trying to get access to the drug industry. You cannot stop the drug industry. It is probably the largest single source of foreign currency in Mexico. It earns $30 to $50 billion a year. Nor can you repeal market economics. There is a market in the United States and other countries for these substances, and these substances will be delivered. I've seen no reports that are credible since this war, or officially called the war, started 3 years ago, of any shortfall in any place in the United States of any drug, nor any deterioration in quality, nor any increase in price. So whatever's going on, it certainly doesn't interfere with the people who ship drugs to customers here.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Charles Bowden, the author of Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's out from Nation Books, and it's a really powerful book. And I recommend, highly recommend the book to everyone.
I'd like to hear that, Mike.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm telling you, Charles, I've been sitting home and I've been so immersed in this. And like I said, the artfulness in the way you present the thing adds to the power of the exposure, because it really puts you in there and you feel it, you know, and to me that's extremely important.
One thing I wanted to do, mm-hmm. and I'll tell you why. If I say 5,000 dead people, it's a number.
Mm-hmm.
And I am no different than anyone else. It just somehow passes through my mind. This is an entire city with universities and everything being essentially slaughtered and murdered. And I wanted to make people feel that, because, look, all I know how to do is write. It's the only way I can make people pay attention. So I gave it my best shot. My next life, I'll learn how to play a guitar.
Okay, and we'll have you back, too, okay?
Yeah, it is my goal.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, one of the things that again, this thing of what people are subjected to, and when you look at this, there's the, you know, you mentioned the military and the role of the military in Juarez and in these murders, and then there's the police who themselves either hire assassins or hire themselves out as assassins or just carry out their own thing, and then there's these groups, which, you know, I thought was important for people to understand. Some of these assassins are trained by the FBI. Some of these groups, the Zetas, were trained as a paramilitary force by the U.S. government. I mean, this is, yeah. There's some very, in addition to the big money, there's actually some very hands-on training going on here.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of amateur sicarios or assassins now. But in the book, there's a real one. A guy who was a commander of the state police in Chihuahua and in Juarez, and was trained by the U.S. FBI. And for 20 years, killed people as ordered for money. He told me he knew personally where 600 people were buried in the city secretly. But what you have to understand is until President Calderon initiated this war, all these things existed, but you didn't have 5,000 butchered people. That something has changed. And what I think has changed is that war has reached a point where it escaped the control of anyone, meaning there is no one sitting in a cartel that can pick up a phone and stop the violence. There is no one in government that can pick up a phone and stop the violence. Since the Mexican army arrived en masse in Juarez, every month the violence has gone up. But this has gotten a life of its own, and it's because of the poverty and the social disintegration. I mean, people live there without running water. They have to steal electricity. That there are many, many groups of predatory human beings robbing, stealing, and killing, and nobody knows how to put Pandora back in the box. They can't even admit Pandora's gotten out of the box because they'd have to question U.S. trade policies, namely NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Treaty, which has destroyed the Mexican poor rurally and destroyed small industry and created slave wages. And my God, they would have to question our drug policy, where we create this essentially a gangster culture because we won't let our fellow citizens ingest things we don't approve of. You can have a Big Mac, but you can't have a joint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Juarez, among many other cities, including U.S. cities, becomes a slaughterhouse because of this.
Now, let me ask you this. You make a very chilling point in the book. And again, the poetry here was, you know, drove it home, that violence isn't a deviance, but a logical career decision in this society. That it's become part of the fabric of society in Juarez, that it's not a breakdown, but a flower springing up from a bed of rot. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's a rational choice. You know, they did a university study was done in Chihuahua, which was a state Juarez is in, and it's physically the largest state in Mexico. They found out that 40% of the young males wanted to become sicarios when they grew up. Well, this is not an idiotic decision. You can find the same thing in various American cities in certain parts of the city. They know if they become a sicario or get into the crazy life, they will die. They might make it to 20, but probably not 25. But at least for a few years, they'll have the girls, they'll have a car, they'll have a rush in their life. They don't have other options. And Juarez, there's one high school for every 500,000 people. Those high schools you have to pay to go to. It's a very rare individual that can afford to go to a university. The factories there start you at $40-odd dollars a week, and if you're a real good person, you'll wind up at $75 a week. This is in a city where every price you pay every day for everything will be roughly 90% of the same as what you'd pay in the U.S., and so going into this life that I don't approve of, killing people, robbing, and stealing, is not an insane decision. It's a rational decision. And you're never going to change it till you change the ground it springs from.
Yeah,
unless these people have a possibility of a life, they're going to create their own life. And the kind of life they've killed now is murder.
Mm-hmm. Isn't capitalism a wonderful thing, man? Isn't capitalism a wonderful thing?
Yeah, well, You know, let's be fair here. Now, I'm not a, I didn't come here as Adam Smith, but what people have to understand is El Paso, which abuts Juarez. I mean, they're physically, you can hardly tell where one stops and the other starts, is at least 80% Mexican-American. Many of the people in El Paso have direct kinship ties to people in Juarez. Now, Juarez has had, as of this morning, 676 murders this year. El Paso has had 2 murders. Hmm. Now, in El Paso, you can get a job. The police are roughly on the level. When you go home at night, the water flows from the pipes. You turn a switch, the electricity is there. I'm led to believe that if you give people some actual security in life and some kind of future, they'll choose life over death. They'll choose building a society over butchering one. But I don't find it magical, or how could this be, what's happened in Juarez. Frankly, what surprises me is it took this long to arrive, because it was built in to both the corruption of the Mexican government and the economic policies of the U.S. government.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing, Charles, is I do think the point about actually even the conditions of life that people face here, oftentimes what we don't see is what we're handed here, what we're living on here, what we're floating in, is actually dependent upon things like what exists in Juarez all over the world. You know, to me, it's a really sharp question that people really have to get their heads around and start to look at. And
I'll pounce on that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You go into a Walmart and you look at those goods, you should look at the floor. The floor is covered with blood. Those foreign objects you get in a Walmart and many other U.S. stores are made by people that are functionally slaves in Bangladesh, China, Mexico, etc. But I don't know how to legislate this, but I don't want products sold that are made by people that get a wage they can't live on. I don't want to buy into that. I'm sitting here fully dressed, I reassure you, and I don't think there's a stitch on my damn body that wasn't made by somebody working in some hellhole. And I'd much rather buy a pair of breeches and a shirt where the people went home at night and had a decent wage. I'll pay more. Mm-hmm. But I can't even find that anymore. But
one final question, Charles, and we have about 3 minutes maybe to do this.
Sure.
You pose the question to yourself, why do you keep coming back to Juarez? And you answer that it's to get a taste of the future. And you say that Juarez is not behind at times, not some kind of whacked out backwater or no man's land, but a sharp edge slashing to the future. And in particular, you say that related to this, all of the proposed solutions to poverty, migration, and crime are erased by waves of blood in Juarez.
That's correct. Look, what I mean is simple. We're living in a world under the global economy of declining wages. The biggest manufactured object in the world now is poor people. We can't wall it off, even though we're building a wall on the southern border. But it's a world where the power of the state's also eroding. Every day in Mexico, the Mexican government has less control. It controls less of the ground. It is not simply being replaced by these mythical heads of drug cartels. It's just dribbling out on the floor with places in sort of a free fall. And to go there and to look at it, is to see a kind of future that I don't think is unique to Mexico. It's just pioneering some of it. And a kind of future that'll spread. Now, the reason I keep going there is simple. I thought what was happening should be recorded, and I read the mainstream U.S. press, and they were ignoring it. I'm happy to say, since 3 people associated with the U.S. consulate there were butchered in March, now the New York Times and other worthies have decided Juarez exists. But when I started this book, I just thought I wanted to get down something. I wanted a record for the dead. I know that sounds bizarre. I wasn't raised to turn my back when people are getting butchered and saying it's of no concern of mine. That's how the book came into being.
And
I would like the book to be out of date. And instantly, Juarez be prosperous and peaceful.
And I'd like the book to be in the hands of many millions of people. I think people need to read this book. Yeah. Charles, thank you very much for the book, for the interview, for doing what you do.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, now, I'm Michael Slate, and you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Charles Bowden, the author of Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and the Global Economy's New Killing Field from Nation Books. Okay, well, after listening to Charles Bowden in the interview today, and after reading his book in particular, I was left with a feeling that, you know, I really want to present some food for thought to people. So I dug this up. This is from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the speech is called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And this excerpt is called Youth Deserve a Better Future. So check it out. I think it'll really give you something to think about. What kind of system is this?
And let's talk about what this system does to the youth every day, to the future, or what's supposed to be the future of the society and the people. People without a job, youth who have no hope of a decent job, who are hanging out on the streets, looking only to something like crime to maybe give them a way to have something and get some respect. Recently, I was reading a book called Turbo Capitalism by a conservative author named Edward Luttwak. And even though he's a conservative, he made this interesting comment. He said, for millions of youth in the inner cities, even taking into account the chances that you'll get killed at a young age or go to jail for a long time, crime is a rational choice. Now think about what he's saying, this conservative author and analyst. He's saying for these youth, crime makes sense. It's the best option they have. And all the time, of course, these same people are preaching to the youth about what terrible things they're doing by doing crime. Well, what kind of system have you got then? If you can say that for millions and millions of youth in the inner city, crime is a rational choice, the best choice they can make under your system. What f***ing kind of system have you got then? Over 2 million people are in prison in this country. The majority of them young people, especially black people and Latinos. Again, I say, what kind of country, what kind of system is this where more money is spent on prisons and jails than on education for people in the inner cities? Why? What good reason is there for so many, while they are still young teenagers, to come to the conclusion that they might not live to be 18 or 21 anyway, or if they do, they will be facing a long time in prison? Look at all these beautiful children, full of life and energy, full of so much promise when they are young, and see what happens to so many of them, what this system does to them as they grow a little older. Once more, I say, what kind of society is this? What kind of system is this? No, this generation and generations to come deserve a much better future, and a much better future is possible. I say no more. No more generations of our youth here and around the world, whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system has destined for oppression and oblivion even before they are born. I say no more of that.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, speaking on Youth Deserve a Better Future. That's an excerpt of a speech. The overall speech is available on revolutiontalk.net. Again, that's revolutiontalk.net. And the speech is called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Okay, that wraps up our show for this week. I want to leave you with some closing thoughts. You know, as we look out at the world, to many of us, it becomes very clear that the world cries out for radical, even revolutionary change. Everything must and can change. That's the controversial and the operative phrase there. And can change. You know, but the more we learn about how things work, about how human society has changed throughout history, even in the face of seemingly impossible odds, then the more possible and real all this becomes to us. Each week on this show, we aim to be part of that process of making it real. Not just showing how much things need to change, but they can change. So keep tuning in each and every week, and together we'll work to bring a better world alive. I want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa. I want to thank Henry Carson for his production assistance, Age for his production assistance. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out with a song from Ricky Lee Jones' new album, the one we were discussing in the beginning of the show. The song is Blue Gazelle, and it's from the album Balm and Gilead. It's a really beautiful song and a unique one for Ricky. It's an instrumental, that's something she rarely does, so listen up and enjoy.